Blueberry, obviously, because if you've got any peat at all in the original swamp condition, your blueberries, our pH is right. Actually, we've got Blueberry City sitting out there. What's the other waterberry?
Cranberry,
obviously. Probably when you put these mounds up, it'd pay you to put plastic over them, while you're thinking. Plasticise the whole thing to kill the docks, and then punch holes and start your small fruit system, and then let the plastic deteriorate. But this is the ultimate in gardening, scooting around in your dinghy, loading up your boat. You probably would, but I should think, you know, this is going to be so damn complicated, it's doubtful whether anything will suffer much. We're finding very good results along the water edges. You can grow a lot of fish in this system and invertebrates, and a lot of fish, eels, of course. This is Eel City you're looking at here. You got some photographs of them? Good. Yeah, it'd be great. I've got a few photographs of the stuff around the airports in Thailand, in Bangkok. I went out in a taxi and got lost in these systems. Had an exciting day getting lost within sight of the airport.
Bill, stuck in the blackberries, when they come out, how far out do they go? Because you have to organise the channel, so it's wide enough so you can still go down in
there. They come out about 8 feet.
You made a pretty
wide place. Yeah, you work out, that's what I say, there would be no fixed harmonic. You'd have to actually work out the bank for that crop. For blackberry bank, the bank would be narrow, the space outside it would be wide. Fish would do very well under that, under the blackberry fronds.
That's right.
And so on. So I'd say that's the ultimate in culture, in agriculture. A very few acres of Chinampa would replace dozens of acres of any other system if it was worked, and I don't imagine if you didn't work it wouldn't last long, because everything can roar it out of it and you'd never get it in control again. I think even for fruit trees, it's worth organising this. Once you do it, it's pretty permanent, and it's easily cleaned out.
Bill, are there different varieties of blackberries, or are they in different growth conditions?
They're all Rosa fruticosa.
There are three different ones growing on the plate, depending on where they grow.
Yes, there are a lot of berries in the group, and they will often hybridised, right? And what's happened in Circular Head is interesting, is the blackberry is hybridised with a native bramble, which is a very small-fruited, low-growing, rather weak plant. And the blackberries are at very low yield because the native bramble was in great quantities, and you'll still find some pure native bramble up on the nut with a little salmon-coloured berry. If you look around the world's cultivated blackberries, you wouldn't have... It's of the Rosa group. It's really quite a mind-blowing experience because, for instance, we just got some seed in. In Germany, they grow a thornless blackberry which is oily-leaved, shiny-leaved, and is carpeting at about that deep. And it's just covered with fruit, so you're walking through a carpet of thornless blackberry with very large fruits. And we just got that in. It's a cut-leaf blackberry. It's certainly a cultivar. And in the States, you've got a lot more sorts of raspberries and blackberries than we've ever imagined, from thimbleberries to bearberries to goodness knows what. Largely, I'd say, a neglected part of agriculture, because they all seem to be local. What they call cranberry in Germany is a little bush about that big, which is grown in clay as a border. what you call a cranberry in Finland is a little bog plant, and what you call a cranberry in the United States is Vaccinium, not Erva ursi, Vaccinium something else, which grows in coastal bogs. And what you call a cranberry in Alaska is Kinkinik, which is a little dune cranberry that grows on cold coasts. So I think we should look across the world's berry fruits, most of which are not listed anywhere in any... I'm getting interested in it, actually. I've been lifting a lot of them into Australia. As far as blueberry goes, it was only about a month or two ago in Washington, D.C., that we were at a house, and we went out and we found a tree along the hedgerows which had blueberries on. The tree was about 12 to 15 feet high, and it had abundant blueberries. We picked them, and then we had a commercial blueberry there, like about as big as a grape, in packet, which we'd purchased. And we put them out and we did a taste test on everybody around, and everybody preferred this tree thing. And we couldn't identify it, but eventually we found it was a service berry, which is a different genus, but it's in rosaceae, but it looks exactly like a blueberry. And it's no trouble to grow, multi-stem, multiple bearing, excellent fruit, much better than blueberries, which are a bloody nuisance to grow. Service berry. I've got some of the seeds of it with me now at home.
What's it called?
Service berry. A melanchier is the genus. And blow me dead, I came home, went into a nursery at Somerset, and there is one solitary pot with a thing in, a melanchier canadensis. That's the same tree. Sold as an ornamental. And they're out blueberries 10 to 1, you know, yield, flavour, and nuisance value, zero. They're a good little hedgerow tree.
We make away from that original.
This also is noted in the literature as liking bottomlands, wet meadows. So like the blueberry, it looks like an excellent sort of chinampa or water edge thing. So you'll be hearing more later about it. We've got one in grower and then we've got more seeds. It's the service berry. It took us a long time to hunt it down in the literature because it's always been noted as being edible, a good edible blueberry, but it's never been brought into cultivation. There are about 10 of them, service berries. Didn't look particularly acid. It grew all along the edges of the fields down at Shahabuddin's place, you know, down there? Down around where Pegan.
The orange strawberry tree
is another fruit tree of some interest. It's coastal. It won't stand, it's not front line, it's second line coastal. It grows anciently in the Mediterranean, where we're now mainly extinct, and it's on the south coast of Ireland.
That's the Arbutus.
Arbutus. Unido. And it's an extremely variable tree. It'll grow from cuttings, luckily. There is one at Deloraine in the public park which has a large, delicious fruit. It's really a beautiful fruit. And most are pretty horrible. But if you look around amongst all the arbutus available, you will find some excellent arbutus. Another tree not widely grown for small fruit. Now, I don't know why this has happened.
People
are
reluctant
to
spoil about things that they don't know, and they might have their
singing
in front of them.
Yeah, well, we knew nothing. See, 1951 here, I brought in the first sweet corn to Tasmania and grew it, and nobody would eat that stuff. 1951.
The sweet corn.
Mm-hmm. That was the year it arrived. There was no sweet corn in Australia before 1950, none. You couldn't buy sweet corn.
Sweet corn?
Sweet corn.
It was all maize.
Oh, maize, you had maize. No. We grew maize from when I can remember for the bullocks. And when we were kids, we ate the young maize cobs, right?
No, this was sweet corn. The grandfather grew
it. Well, your grandfather may have grown it, but sweet corn wasn't sold in the shops here until the middle 1950s.
It wasn't available commercially.
No, and you wouldn't get, and we couldn't sell it. I had a market garden at Smithton at the time, and I couldn't find anybody who'd ever eaten sweet corn and knew what it was. So what I had to do was to go home, ronio a sheet and tell them what to do, give them two cobs with a sheet wrapped around them, and after that I started to sell it. But I simply point out to you that it doesn't take long. I mean, here it is only 1980 and practically everybody will eat a sweet corn. 30 years later they're really adapted, you know. I don't know if you know what vegetables we originally had in Australia. But when we came to Australia, you sort of had cabbages, parsnips, carrots and potatoes. That would be about it. And until the Chinese came in for the mining, we didn't have almost all the rest. And before we went to America, you didn't have any potato. And what was the potato of Europe? Staple root crop was parsnip. Parsnip was a staple root crop of Europe. Imagine living in those days. Or if you want to recreate what it was like to live in medieval Europe on that diet, go and live in Western Ireland. Because there are literally only four or five vegetables, and they are the old European vegetables. Also, in the Berlin Botanical Garden, they've recreated for you the European vegetable garden when it depended on European plants. It's a mighty small garden and it's very bitter and very sour. It's full of strange little roots like skirrets. There's no carrots, only skirrets. Skirret is about that wide, about that long, and it's tough. So I tell you what, our ancestors were pretty tough cookies. They had about five or six miserable little plants, so no wonder they hunted and fished.
It's surprising they didn't look for more.
Bloody surprising they started gardening at all, if you ask me. What?
It's surprising they didn't look for more wild foods naturally.
They didn't look for them, they had them organised. They had a lot of tree crop organised, nut crop. They made all their butter out of beech nuts, and they had a lot of really good nut crop organised. And they ate a lot of wild seeds that we don't eat now. But it's interesting that only over a few hundred years of human history, the garden has come up in an immeasurable way, and it has an immeasurable way to go. You just can't imagine what the Australian garden is going to be like in 50 years' time. I tell you, it's going to be something really different. In the permaculture groups of Queensland, we did an early census and brought in 860 new species of foods, I think, wasn't it? I think it's in excess of that. 860 new species. And in some of those species, like in the guavas, there are 30 varieties, none of which look like another one. You take the limes as a group. There may be 20 to 30 limes, none of which are recognisably like another one. So what we'll be eating by the year 2000, if we're still here, will be a very different array of both vegetable and animal foods. Now that is anentropic. Every 5 minutes that we're here, a species is disappearing from the earth. We will lose I don't know how many species by the year 2000. But if you took circular head as an example, every year we are here, about 200 more species are appearing where we are. So we are the only anentropic system at present, and we've got to hold on until the world comes to its senses, bringing in species to districts. Otherwise, everything's going to run to extinction, and you will never, unless we start moving giant tortoises around, there will not be any on Aldabra or any left in the world. It's really getting weird. I think when you arrive at Chinampa, you arrive at the a very integral sort of system. It's not all properties are suitable. A great many more are suitable than we use in this way. And areas that we have considered unsuitable for agriculture are really very suitable to our system. Go on a slight modification of that, and I'll just do a little bit on marine systems. The profile here is, say, from a true terrestrial system through salt marsh to an intertidal system. And I'll just simply go on here as an extension of aquatic system generally into the edge of the sea.
You've got a big tide here.
8 feet normal, 12 feet sometimes. Sometimes seems to be more than 12 feet. About a month ago there were some spring tides and we could walk way out in the sea. Pull abalones off with your fingertips for a succession of nights. This is the Salicornia zone, or that little fat this is the seagrasses, and they're true grasses, they're not seaweeds. The stuff we're mulched with isn't seaweed, it's seagrass. It's not an algae, it's a grass. And this is a zone of plants not present in the southern hemisphere, but it's probably the richest zone of the northern hemisphere. It's Spartina, of which more in a minute. Her grasses in effect, or grasses and herbs, forbs, go from the edge of trees to the low tide mark and below the low tide mark. Salicornia you all know, and if you don't you can see it around this coast. Whenever there's a raised platform near the sea, you get those little fat red and green plants all over, and a marine tussock, Poa maritima, and you get quite a range of grasses in here. Spartina I want to talk about. Spartina is a grass which grows from just above the tide to just well below the tide. It forms a green band around England and New England and many parts of the United States. It's Atlantic in its distribution. It was interesting in that originally in the British Isles there was a Spartina that occurred here called, I think, S. maritima. And another one that occurred down here in the Wash area, whose name I've forgotten. About 20 years ago, one of the American seagrasses was found growing here. Alternifolia, I think it was. And nobody knows how it got there. May have been a permaculturist living there. It could very well have come by boat or by accident. These two, this grew up to the border of maritima, and then it hybridised with maritima. And the hybrid, which is called Townsendi, it's a fixed hybrid, it was able to colonise the rest of the coast of England, so that England achieved over the last 20 years a complete Spartina zone. that zone is normally not occupied. It's not, doesn't have anything growing in it, it's just sand and shingle. Spartina is rather like the equivalent of in the temperate zones and even to the cool areas of the world of mangroves. And in fact it goes from the southernmost extent of the mangroves or the northernmost extent of the mangroves if you're in the southern hemisphere, northern hemisphere, to the Arctic. Like all things that grow in the edge of the sea, it adds a tremendous amount of mulch to the sea itself. It's the basis of some very large fisheries. And particularly, it seems that off the Spartina beds, there are a lot of shell fisheries, completely absent from the southern hemisphere. They have gooey ducks and quahogs and steamer clams, and all of these live just below the Spartina beds. And it's very obvious to everybody that the large production of mollusks depend on there being a Spartina band. Also just off them, there are fisheries of excellent food fish like bluefish, which are known to be closely associated with the Spartina. They spawn in it, they lay their eggs in it, and the young shelter in there at high tide. And it gives off a tremendous biological richness to the surrounding sea. Where you don't have it, you don't have these things. Where you don't have mangroves, you don't have them either. Mangroves are probably the world's greatest fish nursery. They have their own fish and then they send off the young. For instance, the whole of the shrimp fishery of southern United States is mangrove spawned. Without the mangroves there is no prawn fishery. Like what they call shrimps, we call prawns. It's probable that the Gulf prawn fishery and Queensland one depends on the mangroves. The mangroves are being happily eroded by the Queensland population. They're cutting them down, burning them, using them for different purposes. And as they do so their fishery will collapse.
Well, would that, the mangroves in Adelaide, would that be where the prawns in the Gulf?
They probably have a very big feeding cycle of immature fish in there. I think perhaps we should get Spartina. We have some seed of it. We haven't bothered to germinate it and to start it going in the southern hemisphere. It's one of those things like penguins and polar bears and beavers, all sorts of things which have a hemispherical distribution and which the equivalent niche in the other hemisphere is completely absent. Nothing there. There's no penguins in the northern hemisphere. They almost get there. They got as far as the Galapagos, but they don't occur across the equator.
Haven't you got Spartina down at Taylor Estuary?
No.
Sure.
Positive. Or at least not these Spartinas. Do you think we
Which
have one?
Which species are you talking about?
Eternifolia or Maritima, or Townsend Island.
What happened to Townsendia? I think you got that one.
Somebody got it there?
No, I just read it. It was planted. It stayed on.
Good idea. Let's go get it. Let's go and dig a wad of it out. We want it in the West Inlet. We're looking at the West Inlet. It could have been planted for stabilisation of mud. It's good for that. This Spartina and the mangroves really are our saviour as far as land nutrient loss. They catch most of the silt and most of the nutrient and turn it into available production in the sea. Then we move out a little bit and there sort of is a zone here of true beach in between the tides, particularly on a little more exposed coast. And then we come to the below tide seagrasses, some of which emerge from the tide. They are in three genera. There's Zostera, and you can call them all Zostera and everybody know what you're talking about. And there's Heterozostera, which is a fine one. And there's Posidonia, which we use here, which is a broad-leafed one. The Zostera is long and thin, New Zealand estuaries. Heterozostera is even finer, and there's Posidonia, which is quite a broad-leafed seagrass, flat. Databases of a lot of the swan and waterfowl and brent goose foods. Some geese, some waterfowl, a lot of Australian swan depend on these grasses. You'll notice there are swans from here along to the west coast. Wherever there are not people, there are great swan flocks. There's a swan flock over in the West Inlet of 300 or 400. This produces a lot of seed, this Zostera. It's quite a reasonable size of seed. The wasp is ashore, it can be harvested like any grass, and it was the staple food of various native groups of people. Just treated it as a grain, you know, it was perfectly good grain. Now the people don't bother with it, the seabirds certainly do. And then the Zostera and Heterozostera has a natural autumn shedding time when the old blades fall off, and then they come ashore. They will come ashore in storms at any time of year, but normally autumn, over a very few days in autumn, most of it goes loose and comes driven ashore. Where it comes ashore, like all along the beaches around Adelaide, and a fair bit of it around Perth too, a lot around this north coast of Tasmania, along through the islands, thousands of tonnes of it arrive on the shoreline, and it's very little used by us. Let's look at some uses of these seagrasses. Apart from a grain use, which we don't use, they compost readily. We mix along there, shoveling another tonne of them off the truck this morning, I noticed. We would lift, 100, 200 tonnes a year into the town. By the time you get from the beach to where you are, it's already heated up at the base. It's quite a high temperature. It readily composts in the wet state. That means that it alone, you could pick it up and compost it. We should do this, and we haven't done it. It would generate sufficient heat for a household. 7 tonnes of it will generate enough heat to heat a household for 20 months at 150 Fahrenheit. All you have to do is to compost it in an insulated open bay and run hot water pipes at the base and on the sides of the bay so you can shovel it in and out easily. A 20-tonne heap is almost a commercial heating arrangement for factories or to produce enough hot water at 150 Fahrenheit to 160 for commercial operations. Now, once you have composted it, it becomes a totally neutral, fibrous brown substance, which you can get the characteristics of from the Australian Standards Association. It has a zero fire rating, and it has the same insulation value as fibreglass, but without the disadvantages that fibreglass and asbestos has for insulation. It's sold as alpinite, and I think that's merely to confuse you. Just makes you think it comes off the mountains, you see. Sea moss. Alpinite. Alpinite is marine in its origin. It's simply composted Zostera. Even the method of composting was known way back. We know of houses insulated with zostera in Scotland, which the insulation is simply zostera uncomposted stuff between double rock walls, and they're cosy, and it shows no deterioration after 200 years. There's nothing in it on which pests can feed because it's basically a silica skeleton. So it doesn't deteriorate, it doesn't host any pests, it doesn't burn, and it has a very high value as an insulator. And there's enough of it washes on any Australian coast to insulate Australia annually, really, especially, say, around Perth or around Adelaide. Adelaide just has miles of it. Yeah, you do, because everything that lies on the beach belongs to the Crown, any flotsam, unless it's a danger to shipping, in which case it's yours by the law of the sea. Well, this could be a danger. If you can make a very small ship, you could probably sink it on. But your scavenging licence is very slight. It's $4 a year. We pay for 700 tonnes, so it's no big deal. And I think we should start to utilise it. It's one of the things we want to do in Stanley, but neither Heather nor Dave nor Rennie nor Andrew nor I have time. But one day we hope we'll get it going as a insulation industry. It's not only the zostera at Stanley, there are another 2,000 or 3,000 tonnes come in on the islands and so on. We need a little barge to go and get it. But at $12 for 7 kilograms, there's another few million dollars lying around, as usual, on the beaches. And as a mulch, it's a marvellous mulch. It's got a peculiar characteristic, is the first year you mulch, it lasts for 2 or 3 years. By about the second or third year, it develops its own particular bacteria set and starts to break down, and breaks down about the same rate as other mulch after about the second to third year. Forms excellent soil. If you bury it, it doesn't break down. So it's purely a surface mulch. We've used it satisfactorily for everything. On the zostera, there is a whole swarm of associated small life forms. Some of them fixed lime, others are little zooids, and there's little shells attached to it. So when you collect zostera, you get little bits of crabs and shells and lime. So you're continually adding small amounts of other nutrient with the zostera.
So if you were to use that as an insulation material,
it's its best use. Yes, you have to compost it. That's all that. All the organic material burns out of it.
Do you have salt problems in your soil?
No, none at all. You can put it on ring and wet. Now, I wouldn't advise you to collect zostera in a high evaporation desert and put it on ring and wet. I'd advise you to pile it up on the shoreline till it rained and then put it on, or water it down and put it on. If you haven't got salt to start with, zostera won't bring it in. But if you've got a solid situation, I wouldn't bring in wet zostera to it.
Bill, I've collected it at Port Arlington, and quite often it's got what look like earthworms in that. I think they are earthworms. It's a bit surprising to find them so close to the coast.
Yeah, they would be a particular earthworm. They would be a species that probably is marine or submarine. We've collected here in the old beds, which nobody ever collected. It's like peat. It forms a sort of a tobacco. Yeah, I'm thinking about it. But there's no doubt in my mind that its highest level of use is A, to compost it for domestic hot water systems, and B, to use that compost material for insulation.
Well, look at it for insulation, and I've read you need to feed it with boric acid or something to make it fire retardant.
Well, did you get? We have got the Australian standards on it, and they say fire rating zero of composted zostera. But you can put some borax in if you want to, just release the CO2. You can do a fast open compost with 10 turns in about 20 days. Takes longer. All depends on whether you want to use it as an energy source or not, and we do. We would like to. My house is in a sort of a bad position. I sometimes look at that bloody woodshed in the side and think I'll build a double-walled insulated building and just fill it annually with seaweed and run the whole house heat off what apparently is a garage. I think I might very well do it. I keep on thinking I'll do it, and maybe one day I will do it. But I don't have much room around that house to set up a compost situation.
Well, you take this product, you take the pipes underneath the floor, like you would.
You put the yes. You would build an insulated room or an insulated pit, and you would run the pipes on the walls of it, because it'd be a damn nuisance laying pipes in the compost and then digging it out again.
Mm. But through the house, you'd circulate it just a little bit.
Yeah. Or the other way you could possibly do it is lay it up around a hot water tank in the cylindrical tank through the centre of the heap and run a large volume of water through the tank. That would be just as good, or even perhaps better, who knows.
7 tonnes of it would just about fill
this room. No, it wouldn't. 7 tonnes of it wouldn't fill this corner up to the windowsills. It's the ton goes on a utility load. Mick's always shoveling a ton of it off along there. That's pretty well got the springs flat when we heap it up on the ute, and that's a true one tonner. Burns off the CO2. It oxidises. You just struck a great truth, my boy, that the best attachment to a glass house is a compost heap. And people have started to do it. You build your glass house to have a compost heap coexisting with it, either inside it or just adjoining, so that both the heat and the CO2 enter the circulation of the glass house. Posidonia hardly ever is revealed except at low tide. Heterozostra comes well up in very quiet waters above low tide and lays like a flat green hair. And Zostra goes into and out of the tide, including it goes into the Posidonia zone.
Do these just have low tide?
No, they're universal, global.
Yeah, when that tide goes back to the shore.
No, you've got to go to the West Inlet across the back of the Green Hills, about a mile away. The Posidonia grows out in Bass Strait, or you know, right out through Bass Strait, and in rough weather you get some strands of it.
What's that stuff?
The big mass of the seagrasses grow in the inlets and in the sounds through the islands.
You can see these strata from the outer Lake Hyde. About
yeah.
A mile away.
Oh yeah, you can walk out and wade around in it if you want to at low tide. You have to walk out 2 miles, and then about another half mile the water shallows off, and then you're in thick as zostera, and it's full of all sorts of things.
Yeah,
a lot of
skates,
stingrays, little fish make circular breeding holes in it, the little, and they run around in pairs inside those. Pike feed in it, big pike. It's full of stuff. No, it's best to let it come ashore. There is a natural cycle. I think it'd be a shame to start harvesting at sea. We don't know quite what would happen then. But I think a barge would be the shot to go get it off the islands and bring it here. Yeah, after it's come ashore. There's a lot of it doesn't come ashore. What happens? Let's take a look at an inlet like that. This is the sea out here. We get the impression, standing here looking at the sea, that the sea comes in and goes out. And I'm sure it's in all your heads that that's what happens. The sea comes up the shore and goes down the shore. But if you think about it, at low tide, that is there, that's where the sea is, and the sea actually comes in and goes out. And you really did know that. Therefore, what you're looking at is a longshore travel on the down and a longshore travel on the incoming side, rising longshore, that's all. What you see is the water coming up, and that's how you think it happens. What usually happens in estuaries is that most of the zostera that comes away actually travels out on the longshore drift and goes out to sea and rots and forms part of the mulch of the sediments further out. Just a very small hook of some sort out from the shore in stone or a fence or anything, and you get thousands of tons more zostera than you've ever seen ashore. Because most of it has travelled to sea. Now sometimes they are made accidentally as wharves, sometimes like in this inlet, in the West Inlet it comes out, there's a natural hook in the shoreline and then it goes out and the zostera just ends up there, some of it, maybe 1,000 tonnes a year, maybe 50,000 tonnes a year goes past it. Just doesn't arrive there. It goes on out, is dashed to pieces, blows ashore, disseminates, is not recoverable. Well, none of them are seaweeds. All other seaweeds are algae. And all the things that come up on this beach are seaweeds or algae. And they come up from here right out to the North Point. Large numbers of all sorts of algae, of which we have eaten 9 of them, of which about 5 of them are delicious. So there's a lot of edible seaweeds coming ashore. In fact, it's true to say there's no such thing as an inedible seaweed. They're all can be eaten, you've just got to know how to cook them. There's one seaweed which is very poisonous. It's a very fine green seaweed like hair. A very fine green hair-like seaweed, probably you shouldn't eat it. There are fine green seaweeds which are edible, but you better bet, take a bet on it and see who's going to... all the red seaweeds are edible. No, one of the fine green ones is inedible, is poisonous. So we don't eat any really fine hair-like seaweeds, green, red or brown, although there's no brown ones like that. What we've got here is a suspect green one, none of that red one, and the rest of the stuff we eat, or we don't eat it enough, we've eaten quite a lot of it.
Bill, before you go on, do the seaweeds behave in a similar fashion to the sea grass as far as composting in deep generation?
They're much more difficult. Their gel content's very high. They tend to... they're difficult to compost. You've got to add a lot of dry material to compost seaweed because they tend to slime out and make an anaerobic condition and really start just to make an anaerobic compost. Much more sensible to put seaweed through a methane system than it is to compost it. Because it has quite high sugars and it will ferment very readily. And it's much more sensible to treat seaweed anaerobically.
We've got a little brown one that's very thin, like paper, and comes up by the tons. And that generates seed very quickly. I wonder whether it is a seagrass or a seaweed.
Oh, seagrasses are like grass, grass-like. If it's fans out and makes little blades, it's algae.
Bill, do these seagrasses occur on the east coast?
Yes, they do. They occur at least up around southern New South Wales. How far they go, I don't know, and they go right around to Perth. And of course, places like Ceduna, we just load them in. I mean, that's Ceduna, there must be I would hate to calculate the amount of seagrass in on the Ceduna beaches. It's many, many thousands of tonnes. We use it in the Aboriginal settlements there. We get it by about the 20-tonne load, I guess. Great day. Pile on the truck with a trailer on. 20 troops. Lots of beer and ciggies. Down to the coast. That's the basis of a fairly large industry here. It's worked only on the kelp torn loose by the sea, which is good. And the industry is on King Island, and a lot of it is salvaged by horses because you can't get down to the coast with machines. And they pull it up ashore, then they hang it in vertical racks, about a couple of acres of them, till it dries. Then they put it through a very strong chipper and fire it in a gas-fired furnace, fire it through a rolling furnace so it becomes brittle. Then they powder it and export it to Scotland. It all goes to Scotland, I think.
No. Sea salt.
You can buy a bit here. That's a nice change.
They cook it in Launceston where you have a look while
they're down. Oh, good. I'm pleased they're processing here. It was all processed in Scotland.
They also, I think, the stuff they dry, they chip right up,
yeah,
either into a powder.
Powder, almost a powder.
Or small chips for animals.
Yeah.
For feeding to animals.
Yeah, I know it well. I bought a fair
and
bit of it.
And the sea salt, they just... I don't think they just let it dry and then they boil it up in their boilers there and sell it as a liquid.
Yeah, a potato bag of dried bull kelp, you can't lift it. It's like sort of 300 pounds weight or something.
Is this possible thing for building a mineral?
Opinions vary. I think it's been given a lot of fairy tales. I think it's excellent gel in soil. I think it holds quite a lot of minerals. Beyond that, I don't think it's anything so wonderful. A lot of trials have shown that some of the soluble gels of seaweeds aren't making much difference to crops.
Yeah.
Really,
this,
they're not.
Well,
that works all right. You know, seaweed is absorbed on the leaves, liquid seaweed solutions, and you can get a very fast response by using liquid seaweed on crop. That works very well. But also, now we're back to curly leaf. People have said spraying liquid seaweed on peaches will stop curly leaf dead. So we might try it.
Yeah, we found that.
You found it? Foliar sprays?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I've heard that that's very effective on curly leaf. Well, we've got a big farm in the sea, on the edge of the sea, which we haven't used much yet.
I just want to ask a question about the liquid sea grass or liquid seaweed.
That's seaweed.
Seaweed, that's an algae.
It's an algae.
That's distinct from the grass.
Yeah, this isn't bull kelp you've got here. You haven't got any bull kelp. Bull kelp's about that wide, about that thick, and goes for 25 feet. And you can cut tennis balls out of the stems and they bounce about as well as rubber. You might get an occasional frond of bull kelp in a big storm on the beach, but it's not a rough enough coast, would you believe, for bull kelp? You've got to go to the real rough coast for bull kelp. You would think that was a rough coast, but it isn't. You've got to go to Cape Grim and you'll see a rough coast, and then you'll see bull kelp there.